right, everyone. It's Monday, December 23rd, 2019. Yes, this is Arnie. I sound like crap. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. We are like, this is one of these weeks where you're taping shows in the morning to go into a show now in order to tape a show because we know that everyone's going to be on vacation. So we're trying to sort of accommodate all these sort of crazy schedules. But this is our Rethink the Week. So we're going to be joined in studio shortly by Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University. I see that Ron Abramson is already in studio, so he is here. He is an immigration attorney. He is based in New Hampshire, and you are now affiliated with?
Shaheen and Gordon,
Shaheen,
PA.
Shaheen and Gordon, PA. There you go. All right, and so you want to sort of make some opening remarks, and then I'm going to try to read something that I promised I would read because I was at church yesterday, and they read the poem that was read at the homeless vigil, and I was so blown away because I had heard a portion of it. But you know, when you're standing outside and it's so cold, you don't necessarily hear all the words. But it was very powerful, and I think one that everyone needs to hear, no matter what community you live in. So, Ken?
Sure. I have an article about Congress and the healthcare industry, amazingly enough, showing difference between words and act. Vilified by lawmakers from both parties for months, the healthcare industry this year appeared to face an existential threat to its business model.
Mm-hmm.
But this week, pharmaceutical companies, hospitals, insurance companies, and medical device manufacturers practically ran the table in Congress. They won hundreds of billions of dollars in tax breaks and other gifts through old-fashioned lobbying, re-exerting their political prowess.
Wow.
It's the No Special Interest Left Behind bill of 2019. That's what it feels like this is, said Andy Slavitt, a former health administrator who served in the Obama administration. There's no other explanation.
Wow.
And to the surprise of people who think the Democrats are different, support came from virtually every corner of Congress. It's shocking. A bipartisan push to curb the practice of surprise medical billing. When the hospitals just give you a surprise and
so
they've got all these
extra people. We should sit down with Gene Shaheen and Maggie Hassan, who,
network.
You know, use this as a very important issue for them.
Was delayed until next year.
Oh.
And Minority Leader Chuck Schumer worked behind the scenes to raise objections to the package, but didn't work.
Didn't work.
A bipartisan bid to rein in prescription drug prices failed to advance. Chuck Grassley blamed Mitch McConnell for blocking the effort. Pharmaceutical firms also want extended protections for select patents as lawmakers tucked 17 words into page 1,503 of a bill that obviously nobody read that critics allege could amount to billions more in profits for the industry.
Wow.
So, you know, they have patents for a huge number of years to recover their R&D costs.
Yeah.
But let's just extend the patents so no generic people can make it cheaper. And it goes on and on.
Well, thank you.
Anyway,
I'm so uplifted.
I thought I'd share that good news with you.
Thank you so much. All right, before we get to our guests for our Rethink the Week, this is the Homeless Memorial Vigil poem that was read on Thursday, and I want to share it with my audience. During your lifetime, you saw the best and worst of our city, the beauty and the ugliness of its changing seasons, the goodness and the cruelty of its people. Through your eyes, the glory of our ancient buildings are revealed in first light. You saw the rising sun touch the golden dome before other eyes have even opened. And through your eyes, the detritus of a careless night unfolded. Broken bottles, fast food garbage, and displaced shopping carts defiled the pavements and alleyways that you call home. You saw the sun grow brighter and felt its heat warming your bones. And watched your tented village wilt in sticky humidity that made you think you'd never be clean again. You saw the leaves grow bright and jewel-like colors and watched the wind take hold of your shelter and the rain drench your sleeping bag. You saw the freshly fallen glistening snow and watched it turn to black and gritty slush that soaked your shoes and froze your feet. You saw the first precious buds peek through the barren earth and watch your friends lose their footings in slimy mud that caught you, too, unaware. You gazed with gratitude on friendly faces and hands that reached out to give you hot meals, groceries, warm clothes, blankets, and dignity. And you averted your eyes from the hostile glares and closed your ears to hurtful comments intended to be overheard. And while you witnessed the beauty and ugliness of the city, your days were filled with blending in, with not being seen, staying just the other side of society's blind spot. Your beauty not celebrated, your gifts and talents not called forward, your pain, your sorrow too went unwitnessed. But here in the cold and dark of this moment, we light a candle and our eyes are opened. We see you in all your fullness and all your godliness. And we notice the flicker of our candles. We hear you, your stories, hopes, dreams, and aches. May this moment be a beginning of not turning away, but looking deeply into each other, of noticing the sacredness of life within each of us. May the lights we hold be the light we carry into the world, casting out the shadows of fear and indifference. Yeah. So
that was written by Carlos Chahola Strait and
Kate Atkinson. It was I have to say it's incredible. And they read it again at church on Sunday, and I had heard portions of it at the vigil on Thursday. I'm so glad I got to sort of read the whole thing. It makes me cry, because the idea of wanting to be not noticed was exactly how they live. You know, this is a story I told the minister of church on Sunday. When I was running for governor in 1991, there was a young Asian woman about age 15 or 16, and she asked to volunteer. And we said, of course, we'd love it. And then she would stay, and she kept staying later and later and later. And I kept thinking, you know, you have to go to school, you have to go to home, you have to go to bed. And she would stay later. And for the first couple of months, it never occurred to us. She lived in a car with her mother. She lived in a car with her mother. And we realized how mentally ill her mother is, and she was in some ways taking care of her mother. And one of the women on my campaign basically wanted to become her guardian. And so we went through the campaign. We lost. The woman who wanted to become her guardian, work with her, tried moving heaven and earth to make this happen. And about a year and a half after the campaign, she committed suicide. So in a way, it touched all of us, and it was just so brutal. But she didn't want to be noticed. She didn't want people to know how she lived. She just wanted to have people see how talented she was, and she was incredibly talented. But I feel like we now are living in a society where we are pointing out everything that is different. The othering of our country under Donald Trump has just been kind of mind-blowing. So joining us right now, let me just grab him on the phone. Let's see. Dave, can you hear me?
I can hear you now.
Okay, Dave can hear me now. All right, everyone. It's our Rethink the Week. Dave Schultz is a professor of law and professor of political science at Hamline University in Minnesota, and he is joining us. So I almost don't even know where to start. So I guess I'll start with, since our faraway guest will let him sort of address the issues. As you kind of look back at this year, if you saw the potpourri of articles and links I gave you, it was not about the last week. It was about really, to some extent, the last year. So Dave, as you were looking back and are sort of trying to assess where we are, who we are, how we are moving forward, what is one of the issues that seems to sort of just pop into your brain and say, oh my God, you know, this is one thing we cannot let go of, we cannot forget?
Well, I have two observations. Observation one is that everything that I think that happened this past year was almost entirely predictable. And what I mean by that, the Trump presidency has rolled out exactly the way I think we would have expected it to be, is one where he would be sloppy, not understand the Constitution, would set himself up in terms of thinking he could fight with everybody else. And eventually, when the Democrats took control of the House of Representatives, the collision course towards impeachment and towards conflict was there. So that's the first thing. The second thing, what stands out, all the links that you sent me, and including, I'd say, a links that you didn't send me, is the fact that we remain, at the end of 2020, almost completely blind to the fact of what class exists in America, and that the gap between the rich and the poor, and that the politics of the rich and poor really isn't the defining issue of today, but largely it's being ignored.
Wow. So how do you respond to that, Ron? That's absolutely true. I mean, we're at the we're at the peak of inequality, at the peak of inequality. And despite the fact that we have this incredible low unemployment, I just saw a statistic this morning. A third of the counties in America have seen a rise in poverty, not a decline in poverty. And here's the kicker. In Texas alone, 83 counties saw a spike in poverty, and yet Texas is the fastest growing state in the nation. You know, it's the future of America. It has this rising economy, and yet 83 counties in Texas actually saw a spike in their in the number of poor in those counties. So, you know, you're absolutely right. It is striking that it is there, but it is not discussed. Ron?
Well, it just shows you who influences the discussion and the messaging and the tone really at the national level, because the official line is the economy is very strong.
Yeah.
And, I mean, people – the unemployment is historically low. There may or may not be you know, some statistical anomalies contained within that. But you're talking about one of these situations like we used to say where, you know, they'll say – there's such low unemployment, and someone will say, I know, I have three jobs.
Exactly.
And it's the classic way that money is flowing to ever more to a smaller and smaller group. And the message is that the rising tide is lifting all the boats, but not everyone even has a boat. So some people are drowning.
Exactly, exactly. Joining us right now in studio is Dean Spiliotis. Dean Spiliotis is a civic scholar and a presidential scholar at Southern New Hampshire University. He has a blog, nhpoliticalcapital.com. He's a regular on New Hampshire Public Radio. So, you know, we were just talking about sort of the idea of the class issue is sort of there, but no one's discussing it. Actually, one of the first articles that I posted for today was from Mother Jones. Trump's food stamp cuts will be devastating to Trump country. So in a lot of ways, Trump can sort of turn around and say, oh, you all have jobs. You don't need food stamps. Things are going so well. And yet the opposite is probably true. And yet the people who are going to be the most harmed are going to be the same people who are going to dutifully vote for him, Dean Spiliotis, in 2020. Like somehow they don't connect the dots between their hunger, their lack of job opportunity, their inability to access health care. And yet this is the Trump economy.
Well, you know, we've talked about this before, why people sometimes vote against what appears to be their own economic self-interest. And, you know, there's a lot of damage that can be done through regulatory rulemakings in the federal bureaucracy, changes in qualification thresholds, duration of benefits, all those kinds of things. And it's kind of invisible to most people. It really only impacts the people who are depending upon the government for that aid. So, you know, it's certainly in the President Trump's interest to talk about the kind of statistics that make the economy look good, the full employment,
right,
et cetera. You know, one place where there is a lot of discussion about classes in the Democratic primary. I mean, we that last debate, we kind of slid into almost full-blown class warfare. So Democrats are certainly talking about it, if not Trump.
Okay, so let me just – we touched on this. We taped a show earlier this morning. So, Dave, I want to talk about these caves. Okay, so like this is – I want to know about – I mean, money and politics has been –
Just for the listening audience, we're basically in a really fancy cave right now.
We are, right. At the IBEW basement is where we are right now, a very fancy cave.
No,
there are no crystals.
Wine. No
$900 wine and no crystals.
No wine, period.
But Dave, here's the kicker. I mean, this is not about wine caves. It isn't about big donors, but it is about money and politics. And I think what is so interesting about the Bernie Sanders and the Elizabeth Warren campaign is that they don't hold fundraisers. And I will tell you, as someone who's run for office both at, you know, the national level as well as the state level, I remember when I'm running at the national level, one of the things that I was told by the fundraising staff from Washington, D.C. was they sent me a list of all the places I was supposed to go, all the PACs I was supposed to ask. And I said, I can't. This is not who I am. I'm not going to ask these people. And here's what the national fundraiser said. Oh, we've been told that you are going to be difficult. I mean, that was the language that he used, like, tisk, tisk. Who the hell got you to run for office? And you know, but that was 1996. I mean, we're now in 2019. And I think because Bernie and Elizabeth have shown a different model, you know, those that have been living with the old model are like now terrified because, you know, now what do they do? They obviously need to raise cash, but they're not getting the same kind of je ne sais quoi as the other two. So what do we do?
Okay, so two observations. One's a story. One is that Archibald, I used to be the head of Common Cause Minnesota many years ago, and I brought when Archibald Cox was still alive. Remember, he was a special prosecutor from Watergate. He gave a talk once to our group, and he had the best line I've ever heard. And he said, the rules about money in politics are the rules that determine the rules of the game. And I thought that was such a profound statement, because he said, it's politics at the end of the day is about who's allowed to give how much to whom, et cetera, et cetera. And I think he fundamentally remains correct. Now, having said that, what Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren are showing is that you don't have to completely rely upon, or even if at all, on corporate money to be able to run for campaigns and elections. That's the good news. The bad news is you still have to raise an incredible amount of money to still run for office in the United States, and that still becomes a problem, because that's another place where class comes in. It's not just in terms of you funding your own campaign, but it's in terms of what? Wealthy people knowing other wealthy people. It's people being connected to donors and so forth. And even though they're giving us good news, at the end of the day, I bet if you talked to Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders and they said to them, do you like the idea that you're spending 50 to 60% of your time just begging for money? They would probably say no.
But they're not. I think that was one thing that's so interesting, Dean. My understanding is that they don't spend time begging for money. That this is in part this sort of whatever kind of campaign and enthusiasm. They have these small donors that are willing to do. I mean, I hate to say this, social media is the best thing that ever happened to small donors. Because I can send you $10. I wake up in the morning, I'll send you $10. I mean, that's my disposable income. What, Dave?
Yeah, okay. So maybe they're not begging in the way that let's say a Peter Buttigieg is begging, but the fact of the matter is, I'm on their email list and I'm getting multiple emails a day from all of them, still asking for money. And the point I'm trying to make is that at the end of the day, we still don't have a political system that isn't dependent upon money.
So Dean, what am I going to do with this cave thing? Do I make this? Is this an issue? Do I care?
It's an issue for maybe the progressive base of the Democratic Party. I don't know that it's a big issue for people outside.
So Ron, do you think either Bernie or Elizabeth will basically say no to any kind of money coming in after they win the nomination? Are they going to say that anything coming from a billionaire is tainted, so I don't want it? Knowing that Donald Trump is going to be literally wallowing in cash. What if Mayor Bloomberg decides that he wants to help out because he doesn't get the nomination? We're going to tell him no because you're a $54 billion billionaire or whatever? I'm just trying to figure out, how do you proceed going forward without being naive, with being practical, also understanding that you hate the idea of money in politics, but because we haven't necessarily drained the system of money in politics, you still have to do something.
Absolutely. And that's the challenge. Nobody can or should unilaterally disarm.
Right.
That this issue started to come up, years and years ago in the context of, renouncing federal funding.
Yeah.
When campaigns started to realize they could do much, much better renouncing federal funding and not putting a cap
exactly.
on what they could raise.
Exactly.
And so, that was before Citizens United. And now, I don't know. I think, so much of a primary is symbolism.
Yes.
And that's what this is, optics, symbolism. And to have a campaign like Mayor Pete's try to bludgeon Elizabeth Warren for some of her past fundraising practices, it feels a little unfair, because what she's basically done is say, I've done all that. I don't like it. It doesn't work. It makes me beholden to interests that are not, egalitarian or not truly populist, and trying a different way.
I will say, fair or not, I thought it was somewhat effective, and that's a problem for her in that debate, the way he went after her.
Yeah. Oh.
He then got kind of knocked aside a bit by Amy Klobuchar, but that initial exchange where, he kind of came back at her, I understand this. I think the earlier comments about the system and just the system we have, and, look at the kind of decisions that have come out of the Supreme Court over the last 15 to 20 years. It's just the system we have. Having a debate in the primary over who's the most virtuous fundraiser, I mean, that's important to some people in the grassroots. But in the grand scheme of what people are going to be voting on in November, I just think the way the system is now, for better or worse, it's incredibly expensive. I mean, Trump has raised hundreds of millions of dollars. And so I don't know what the answer is. I understand sort of the downside of it. But You just, I mean, you saw in that debate the back and forth over, you know, no, I, well, you know, you had a wine cave,
and
then
it's
still
going
out, you know, and then it turns out she had a wine fundraiser with Melissa Etheridge. And so the people don't know what the difference is.
I'm so glad I don't drink. I'm so glad I don't drink.
I like wine. I know wine's getting a bad rap.
Let me segue back to Dave's point about there's a huge gap between rich and poor and nobody is talking about it. Elizabeth and Bernie are talking about it. That is their main theme. Every speech I've ever heard Elizabeth Warren give, she mentions it many, many times. And that is the fundamental theme of what they're standing for. So, yeah, they may have raised money in the past, but they don't.
Oh, you know what?
They're certainly speaking to the class issue, which is very important.
So wait, let me just say something. So I keep thinking about, you know, how Mayor Pete doesn't want free college for everyone because the rich really shouldn't get free college, even though the rich will be paying for the free college. So I keep thinking, so wait a minute. So it's okay to take from the rich in order to run for president, but you don't want to take from the rich in order to, one, give them free college. I mean, it's like in some ways I'm just trying to figure out, like, when's it good to be rich and when is it bad to be rich.
It's always good to be.
All right, Artie. It's always good to
be
rich.
This is just a variation of the F. Scott Fitzgerald line. The rich are different than us. They have more money.
That's exactly right.
My father used to tell me, rich or poor, it pays to have money.
So let me. I want to just sort of end this segment because this. I can't tell you why this emotionally sort of drains me, but this is absolutely true. So it's 1996, and they pick six of us that are running for Congress to go down for this high donor event in Washington, D.C. You guys, I'm one of the six in the country, okay? And Debbie Stabenow was running as a young freshman congresswoman. And so I'm the last person to speak. And so it's like a cattle call. So there's all these rich people at the table, and there's Gore, and there's Clinton. And they all get up to talk in front of all these very wealthy, wealthy donors. And they all are talking about their prowess with raising money. That's what they're talking about in front of all these really rich people at this. Like, this is a $1,000 plate dinner. And I'm the last person to speak. And I'm looking at these guys. And I get up to speak and I said, I guess I have a question for you. Do you care what I believe? I said, I don't know if I want to talk about my fundraising skills. I do want to talk to you about my political beliefs.
No soup for you.
Exactly. But that was 1996. It was the most – I almost dropped out that night. Ron, I was so disgusted. I was so disgusted. And I thought, my God, am I freaking naive? Am I freaking naive? And so I hear this fight about the wine cave, and I feel like we have not gone anywhere. We are still running in place. This is still part of the conversation. And yet at the same time, Dave, I know we have to win. I'm so worried about it. Yes, Ron.
Did you see that the actress Jane Lynch waded into the whole situation. So she tweeted that billionaires have just as much right to influence the election and the nomination as anybody else. Yeah. And you can imagine she got a little dragged. She said that she's not a fan of class warfare. But it seems like we only use the phrase class warfare when people call out the inequities that are already inherent in the system.
Yes.
I mean, class warfare is a constant state of affairs when the wealth gap continues to grow. Exactly. But as soon as somebody puts words to it and says, hey, this isn't right, let's change things, it gets billed as some sort of, you know, inappropriate or what's the right word, sort of demagogic strategy.
Like there's something wrong with it.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Well, yeah. One of the classic lines is to say that, you know, there's a class warfare going on in America right now, but there's only one class that's fighting. And that's sort of been the problem, because when the other side starts to sort of rear its head and say, you know, we don't like the fact that, you know, that Trump tax cuts have been skewed to, you know, to the upper income level. We don't like the fact that, you know, they're screwing us over with, you know, on the food stamps, et cetera, et cetera. And we start to talk about the politics of rich and poor. Then people start to throw and say, well, you're just talking about class warfare. So it's there, you know, and part of what has been the absolute brilliance, and I say brilliance with a lot of sarcasm, the brilliance in terms of the way politics has shifted. We have shifted away from addressing the politics of rich and poor, and we get distracted oftentimes by other issues that in the larger scheme of things would be addressed if we addressed the issues of the politics of rich and poor.
And on that note, this is the first half of Rethink the Week on The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, producer Ken Barnes. We're joined by Dave Schultz, Hamline University. We're joined by Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University. We're joined by Ron Abramson, labor attorney in New Hampshire. We'll be right back after a little labor history.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 2008. That was the day that Walmart stores agreed to settle 63 wage and hour lawsuits across 42 states for at least $352 million and possibly as much as $640 million. Walmart and Sam's Clubs were accused of failing to pay overtime, requiring workers to work off the clock, erasing hours from time cards, and preventing workers from taking meal and rest breaks as guaranteed by state law. The lawsuits involved hundreds of thousands of then current and former employees. You'd think they would have learned their lesson after having to shell out that amount of money. In fact, they have had to settle at least seven more class action wage and hour lawsuits and remain a defendant in dozens more. By 2012, Walmart had settled at least nine Equal Employment Opportunity Commission cases related to disability, gender, racial and religious discrimination in hiring, and sexual harassment. Egregious labor violations have persisted throughout their stores. Systematic wage theft, health and safety dangers, and abusive conditions on the job have continued for years. Chronic short staffing creates unsafe working conditions. In 2012 alone, they were repeatedly cited and fined by OSHA for serious violations such as blocked emergency exits, lack of safety procedures for control of power hazards, and other problems. Employees who worked with our Walmart organizers often found they were targeted with threats, reduction in hours, and terminations. More recently, Walmart has had to settle a discrimination suit over health insurance benefits for same-sex spouses. The high cost of labor violations and the low wages at Walmart cost taxpayers on average $6.2 billion a year in public assistance for many of their workers.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Most of the lettuce eaten in the United States comes from California and Arizona, regions expected to see more drought as the climate warms. From there, it's trucked all around the country, generating carbon pollution with every mile. But some say there's a better way.
If we all want to enjoy fresh produce, then we need to grow it in many different spots, regionally rather than in just one part of the country.
Matthew Meisel is chief financial officer of Little Leaf Farms.
We decided, let's grow lettuce year-round in New England.
The company grows more than 2 million pounds a year in a 5-acre greenhouse in Massachusetts. Meisel says the greenhouse is not only closer to East Coast consumers. Its location also allows the company to take advantage of the region's ample rainfall.
We don't have a water shortage in New England. We have abundant natural water. We capture rainwater from our roof and we store it, and that's all the water that we use on our crop.
And though farming through a cold winter requires heating and lighting a greenhouse, shifting to renewables can reduce dependence on fossil fuels. So Meisel says the time is right to rethink how and where vegetables are grown. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
When I looked all around me, and what do I see? Nothing but troubles and trouble and misery. Things gonna get better, just wait and see. Gotta stay by my side, darling, just you and just me. God's found a love, man, I say it's hard to find. One day, darling, you'll have some peace of mind. Stay together, darling, just you and just me.
Yeah, right. Things are going to get better. My cold will get better. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arnes and producer Ken Barnes. So tell me, who sings Things Are Going to Get Better?
That is Gallivant, and I just thought we were supposed to be optimistic.
Oh, okay.
Glass is half full, Arnie.
That's right. So our Rethink the Week cast in studio right now, we have Ron Abramson, an attorney, immigration lawyer with Shaheen and Gordon. We have Dean Spiliotis, a civic scholar and a presidential scholar at Southern New Hampshire University. And joining us by phone from Hamline University is Dave Schultz, professor of political science and law. So there are things that are getting better. So let me tell you what's getting better, Dean Spiliotis, mm-hmm. and that is people's affection for the Affordable Care Act.
Absolutely.
I mean, you know, Barack Obama must be sitting there going, oy. I mean, it was the Obamacare. It was so bad. It had a terrible rollout.
Think of how brutal that was to get. That took like an extra year to get legislated.
Exactly.
And people were screaming at town hall meetings. Remember that?
It was amazing.
Yep.
And yet now, Dave Schultz, it is under assault. The court is dismantling it left and right. The whole thing may eventually go before the United States Supreme Court, and yet people actually like it. Every single candidate is talking about building on the Affordable Care Act. The Affordable Care Act is now the floor. You know, I mean, like even below, it's like the basement when you're talking about health care. So how are the Republicans going to thread the needle with all the sort of negativism about the Affordable Care Act, and now it has become sort of part of the fabric of who we are as a society?
Well, this is exactly, you know, what's that old expression? Don't wish for something that might actually come true. And they're actually getting their worst nightmare, which is what? Having the Affordable Care Act declared unconstitutional, potentially. And this is right. It poses a problem for them because they don't have an alternative in sight. And many, many of their constituents, you know, in places like Kentucky and around the country have hugely benefited from the Affordable Care Act. And this now becomes a potential political problem for him. And the reason why I say potential political problem, it comes back to what we talked about in the first half of our discussion here, that first the Democrats, you know, have to make sure that the voters know that it's because of the efforts by Republicans, not just in Congress, but by Republican attorney generals, that the act is being dismantled. So they hang this around the Republicans. But then, two, somehow convince voters that, in fact, they ought to vote on the basis of this. And this gets us back to our earlier discussion from the first half hour, is that voters oftentimes are not voting their economic self-interest. They're voting on other issues. And this is one of those policies that so many of the Trump people have benefited from, yet there's no indication right now that this issue or the dismantling of Obamacare will change their support for Republicans or Donald Trump.
Ron, there is so much chaos out there. We're now focusing on impeachment. You know, the question is Pelosi right not sending over the articles over to the Senate? You know, does the delay make sense? You know, we're talking about Ukraine. We're talking about, there's so much on our plate that actually some of the biggest stories of the year have been completely not discussed because they're so overwhelmed by the sort of the infighting in the 2020 campaign, what's happening with impeachment, and the story of the ACA is to some ways, until you lose your health insurance, you're not going to give a crap about what's happening with what's going on. So I'm just trying to figure out, how do you keep a American public focused in any way, shape, or form when Donald Trump is the master manipulator at distraction? And why the distraction benefits him is because he knows how to pull a headline, pull your eyeballs away from what ultimately should be the policy decisions that define the 2020 campaign. I don't know how the Democrats do this, Ron.
People have to feel it. People have to know, and
people have to feel it.
Like Dave was saying, you have to. I mean, you have people who will lose health care. The Republicans have claimed, or at least the president has claimed, they have a big, beautiful plan that they can unveil right after the election. But it is. I mean, the idea that everything is reactive and everything is, you're either on one side or the other, and there can't be nuance, there can't be discussion. We are certainly in an era where there seems to be almost no compromise. I mean, ironically, on the same day as impeachment, we got the new, you know, the NAFTA supplement legislation. So, you know, there are some disconnects, and everyone's claiming all sorts of wonderful credit for that. But you know, from my perspective, practicing immigration law, you know, every day we're not talking about family separation and children in cages to me is a travesty. Yeah. But like you said, everything comes at us at a breakneck pace. I mean, I run a lot. I listen to a lot of podcasts. If my news-based or politics-based podcasts are 2 or 3 days old, they seem really dated because so much has happened. There's like exactly. – there's just this sort of manipulation of our perception of time.
Exactly. So, what Ron said is so true, though, Dean. I mean, so let me just say something about immigration, the separation of families. It turns out, Ron, that is a very pivotal issue for those undecided voters. They are offended at the separation of families.
More so women.
More so. Well, and women are going to be crucial to the 2020 electorate. And yet the 2020 electorate of women that have voted for Trump historically are absolutely offended by that. But we don't ever talk about this, Dean. It's like, where's the space to have the conversation? You know, and I'm not sure. Maybe we need to have a candidate that's been chosen to begin to refine the ability to then sort of talk about these issues. But I don't see Donald Trump giving us permission to do this.
To talk about which, the health care or the immigration?
Any of them. Oh, any of them. I mean, I just feel like not only do we have the 2020 chaos, but I think Donald Trump doesn't want any of these to come out. He is so now able to whipsaw the media. He's got the cable stations doing his bidding. Let's be honest here. I mean, I listen to MSNBC or CNN. Yeah. It is the same thing over and over again, defined by him.
The exception of maybe a little bit on foreign policy, there's really no discussion of a lot of these other issues anymore. It's all about kind of process and fairness and the discussion surrounding impeachment.
This
comes back to, again, you know, the fact that what the Democrats have not been good at doing is defining the narrative and constructing the narrative. And that really, really is, I think, the main one of the issues here. It's that Trump's brilliance, of course, is holding the media's attention, being able to get up at, early in the morning and starting the tweeting and making everybody react to it.
Exactly.
But part of the challenge that we've seen, and I trace this back to Obama. You know, 2008, Obama had a brilliant narrative about change we can believe in. But by the time we get to 2010 and the Democrats are running for election, you know, they sort of run away from the Affordable Care Act. They don't want to embrace it. They don't want to defend it. And really, since 2010, I'm going to argue for a decade now, the Democrats have failed to have the narrative that they need to be able to run, to say, this is what we stand for, this is what we want to do, et cetera, et cetera. This is our vision of the world. And that's what needs to be done. I was talking to one of my students the other day who said, she said to me, if I'm going to impeach the president for anything, it's about what? It's about the family separation at the border. She said, that is just a travesty beyond travesty. And it's like, yeah, Democrats need to be talking about those issues.
So, you know, we just did an interview this morning with Bill Curry, and you'll hear this interview tomorrow. And one of the most powerful things he said is, you know, you listen to a lot of the candidates as they're talking, and the question he wants to ask is the following: do you really mean it? And he was talking about how Obama ran in 2008 and all the sort of progressive values and all the issues, that narrative that you were just describing. And then by 2010, it sort of had disappeared. And then none of the things that he talked about did he actually work on or deliver on. And I think the idea is, not only do we need a narrative, Ron Abramson, I need to get a sense, do you really mean it? And that's the difference between maybe the moderates and the progressives. The moderates don't sound that different from the progressives. I just question whether they really mean it. And that's the part that breaks my heart, that I have to even ask that. But to a large extent, Barack Obama taught me that. So did Bill Clinton. They both taught me that they had this. Go on.
I'm fascinated listening to you because I hear this all the time. I may be the only person in this country who was not surprised that Obama backed away from a lot of the progressive stuff. He struck me during the 2008 campaign as clearly straddling the fence, a very fine line. He got progressives to buy in. He got moderates to buy in.
So what was the signal? Show me. Was there a halo over him?
So when progressives were angry with him in 2010 and 2012, I was thinking, we knew this is what it was going to be.
Yeah.
What is surprising about this? And I've never really understood that.
Who else were they going to vote for?
But the surprise and where there's a very valid critique at the moment is the thought that some, you know, more centrist candidates put forward that somehow we're magically on you know, January 2021 going to be able to engage in bipartisanship and get things done? I mean, that was one of Obama's big miscalculations in my estimation, was that you could go in and people would work together when they were vowing to make him a one-term president from the inception.
So, but Ron, may I introduce you to Joe Biden?
I wasn't naming names.
I know.
I was not naming names.
Listen to what Ron just said. Joe Biden is at the kumbaya. Joe Biden's going to reach across the aisle. I'm going, Joe, what year, what century are you in? And yet, that's exactly what you said. Obama thought he could do this. How wrong was he? Joe Biden was next to him for 8 years, realizing how wrong he was. And Dave Schultz, Joe Biden is running on bipartisanship. Give me strength, Dave. Like, where is this coming from? Like, what moonshot are they on? Because I don't know what Republican they're talking about. Mitch McConnell, whether he's under Donald Trump or before it, there was no kumbaya with Mitch McConnell. There never will be.
Yeah. Now, I was going to say, first off, there was two of us who didn't think that Obama was going to deliver.
Oh, good.
Three.
I'm glad to hear that.
Three. It's a qualification for this panel.
Yeah. So the two of us who didn't think he was going to deliver, you know, you're right. A lot of progressives and dumb people just sort of, you know, swallowed a lot and said, I'm going to vote for him because they didn't like George Bush. But think about it. All the opportunities he squandered in his first 2 years when he had his majorities to do things. For example, you know, the labor supported him because they wanted him to support a revamping of the National Labor Relations Act. He didn't do that. When it came time to, you know, when he took office of the crash, he had an option: bail out the banks, which is what the Bush administration was doing, or bail out the homeowners. What did he do? He continued to bail out the banks. So continuously, he failed to sort of, you know, act in a progressive way. The way I described it once was whenever he had a chance to look into history, he looked aside. He never actually was that transformative president that he had the capacity to be able to be. And so it wasn't a surprise at all to me in terms of what was going on. And I think this is the scary part going into 2020 into 2021. Even if the Democrats get elected, is what? You're not going to get two-thirds. You're not going to have an overwhelmingly progressive House of Representatives. What are you going to do at this point? And they somehow think that what? Winning the election and singing Kumbaya will work. When Obama was at his best is when Ron Emanuel was his chief of staff, because Ron Emanuel scared the hell out of the Republicans, and the Democrats need to do something like that.
So I have a question. So I feel like I'm in this, like, vice, and here's my vice. My vice is nobody can really attack Joe Biden because of the impeachment and because of the Hunter-Ukraine thing. So we're all kind of like have this like little safety moat around Joe Biden. So Mayor Pete's getting a lot of heat, but in some ways he's almost a stand-in, I think, for Joe Biden. He's the young Joe Biden version, and he doesn't have a Hunter son. You know, he's too young.
He has dogs.
And then you were just talking about Obama and the sort of Obama disappointment. But we can't talk about the Obama disappointment because we so miss Obama, because Obama is so wonderful. I'm thinking there's no critique of the past. And yet take a look at Donald Trump.
Well, heck, we miss George W. Bush at this point.
Ronald Reagan was talking about immigrants, so it made our nation great.
Oh my God! So how do we move forward when Donald Trump's success is that he's been able to trash everyone, not just Republicans, but and Democrats, but everyone before him. Democrats are in this position, Dean Spiliotis, where they have to be almost timid, as well as strong, as well as not critique, as well as not be too progressive. I'm thinking, oh my God, we have to thread this ridiculous needle in order to what? To beat Donald Trump? Like, where's the passion in all of that?
That's the debate. And, you know, this is not, it's not a new debate. And there's a belief, there's a split in the party. Some folks believe, you know, we can debate what actually comes of this in terms of policy. But in terms of the actual tactics and strategies of winning a general election, there are still people who buy into the way Clinton did it, the way Obama did it. This is sort of what you just described. The alternative that we're hearing from progressives is, you know, bipartisanship's not going to work, as we just heard,
it doesn't exist.
Right, exactly. So if you believe that, and plenty of Democrats do, then the only alternative really is to try to change it. And that involves, you know, let's say Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders, whoever you want to pick, becomes president. How would you get a Congress that would be in a position to go along with them? Well, you'd have to do that at the ballot box, really. You'd have to change the margins of the two parties. And if the Senate stays Republican, It's not really going to matter. I don't know if it's going to matter who the president is.
So, Ron, one of the big stories coming out this week is the court appointments. Thank you so much. That's exactly where I was going. So why do a significant portion of the Republican base totally understand the power of the judiciary? And why do the other side of the aisle just don't seem to – it doesn't rise to the top one, two, three, maybe even the top 10 issues. And yet in the end, the consequences are unbelievably important. Is it that we haven't taught our civics well? Have we not explained to people the bad decision-making that is – is it they've been so protected in some ways by a more rational court that the idea of what Donald Trump is changing hasn't hit them yet? So therefore, until they lose everything they care for, you know, this is just a theory but not a practice.
That's a big tough one.
If
certain social issues are your priority, then you know how important the courts are. You know how important the courts are on abortion. You know how important the courts are on guns. Mm-hmm. You know how important the courts are on the latitude the president and the executive branch has with immigration. You know, it took three or four tries to get the travel ban in place, but eventually the courts upheld it once they, you know, figured out some of the legal deficiencies. And we're the Democrats are a pluralistic party in identity, but also in ideology and also in priorities. And we never have unanimity. The problem is we're struggling for consensus. And it's a huge challenge because we do welcome dissent and we do welcome all these different voices. But at some point, you know, people do have to decide what is the – are we in a moment of existential threat? And it seems objectively that we are.
So, David, the evangelicals and the GOP, they were in an interesting way given they had their Roe v. Wade. And Roe v. Wade then became basically their calling card. That was what they needed to overturn. And are we beginning to learn that until the liberals or the progressives or the non – I don't know what you're going to call us. But what's going to be our Roe v. Wade? What is it going to suddenly – how much losing do we have to lose before we understand and connect the dots about the importance of the court? We lost on partisan gerrymandering, but that's no big deal. We lost on Citizens United, but that's no big deal. I'm not saying it that way. What I'm saying is think of all the things that we have already lost that have so undermined the democratic process, and it still hasn't translated into it's because of a court decision. Let me remind you, a court decision.
Like Bush v. Gore.
Yeah, none of those things has somehow computed that was because of the courts, and therefore you need to control the Senate, and it's so important. The passion and the understanding of the courts is on one side, but it has clearly never shown up on the other, Dave.
No, I think you're absolutely right, and I wish I could give you a simple answer and say, this is what it's going to take to be able to for the Republicans, or rather for the Democrats, I should say, to sort of have their moment in terms of the epiphany. And part of it is what's going on is that the different factions of the Democratic Party, you know, not just are disagreeing with one another, but are also engaged in a moral high ground with one another. You know, and what I mean by that is that this is becoming kind of like the purity test or the orthodoxy test within the Democratic Party that they're fighting over at this point. The Republicans did this a long time ago, but they've basically settled on it, and they're now lockstep behind Donald Trump. And I'm not saying this is healthy, but the Democrats don't have that discipline. They don't have that sense of orthodoxy because, to a large extent, the Democrats are defined as everything in opposition to the Republicans, but nothing holds them together and nothing drives them to the polls in ways that the discipline of the Republican Party does. And so, again, I wish I could sort of give you a simple answer and say, this is what it's going to take. I don't know what it's going to take,
Dean. But don't I think? But I think there is Velcro for the Democrats, TRUMP. Donald Trump has done everything in every way, shape, or form to offend every one of that big tent Democratic Party. There isn't a faction within the Democratic Party that finds any kind of an affinity for Donald Trump. He's been so destructive on the environment. He's been so destructive on race. He's been so destructive on, frankly, on faith. Even the – no, not the evangelical, but the faith. When you look at what Donald Trump has done, do you really think that this purity test is going to be something that people carry into the voting booth in 2020, given the fact that Donald Trump is the opposite of that purity test? Dean?
Yeah, I said, as I said earlier in the show, I think it's much less of a concern in the general election. People, that's just not what people are focused on. But, you know, I've heard Democrats say that simply running against President Trump is not sufficient, that you need to have this other agenda that's going to motivate and excite people, particularly millennials and younger voters, to get them to turn out in greater numbers, or maybe to bring African-American voters back to the voting booth after 2016. And that's sort of another facet of this debate over tactics and strategy. Certainly, Trump is the kind of unifying thread for Democrats, for sure. But there's still this debate in the party about whether that's sufficient.
And also, I think the debate is not just in terms of whether being against Trump is going to capture a majority of the vote. I think it's going to again. I think the other thing that the Democrats have to be thinking about, and this has been one of my critiques for a while, is that the Democrats lack an electoral college strategy. That Clinton wins, you know, wins by 3 million
again?
Votes.
Again? No. I'm sorry. That the Democrats lack a – this is what – Ron, you just heard him say this. How is it possible that you don't have an elect – I mean, that you don't sleep in Wisconsin, that you don't actually buy homes in Michigan, that you don't understand every address in Pennsylvania? I don't know. How do you not have an electoral college strategy when you've just had your clock cleaned? What does learning take, Ron?
I'm not sure we don't. You know, having some connections to a campaign this time around, I believe there's a lot of math, a lot of calculation, a lot of strategizing about the Electoral College, among other things. But you don't have the luxury in a hotly contested primary to be thinking about the Electoral College yet. You have to get the nomination. The party itself, I mean, that's one of the issues. You know, there
so
are people,
what's Perez
well,
doing?
Well, it feeds into electability. That's the component of it.
So what's the function of the DNC? I mean, I've, other than setting the bar higher and higher for the debates, well, that's one thing. I can do that in about 42 seconds. But shouldn't there – I mean, Nancy Pelosi says we can always do two things at once. You know, no. We can chew gum and do whatever. So we can do impeachment and then we can pass the new NAFTA, whatever it's called. That we can do impeachment and then we can, you know, pass the budget. That we can do impeachment. I want to know what the DNC can do at the same time. I want to know whether the DNC can actually orchestrate this Democratic debate between the 2020, but whether they have a strategy, because no matter who wins, you know, it's not even just what their voice is going to say. We kind of know because they're all on a very similar page, Dean. Mm-hmm. There's not that much difference between Mayor Pete and Bernie. I hate to break it.
Well, and the DNC should be partnering with state and local parties to fund, provide resources in order
to tell
strengthen
the story.
And to be stronger in these areas where there's clear election data that shows that the party fell down in those areas, or the campaigns, wherever you want to blame it on, we know where the weaknesses were for the party the last time around.
Well, you know, so Dave, I keep thinking about the fact that, you know, Nancy Pelosi says that, you know, they've passed 400 bills and they're all, you know, sitting on Mitch McConnell's desk, basically having, you know, they've gone into the basement and they'll never be seen again. Well, you know what I would love? How come everyone doesn't know about every single one of those 400 bills? Mm-hmm. How come they don't know? And that the finger of blame isn't pointed on Mitch McConnell. I mean, you can say that, but the way you say it differently in Michigan. You find of the 400 bills that apply to Michigan. You find of the 400 bills that apply to Pennsylvania. I can do this, and who the frick am I, Dave?
No, I was going to say, this is, to some extent, while we've nationalized politics, all politics still is local at the end of the day. And you still talk about those issues, those bills that are important to your constituents, and you work very, very hard, in terms of doing that messaging, you know, per district. And that's, again, what I think the Democrats need to get better at, not just the general message, but how you message within particular jurisdictions, particular states, And where the DNC, I think, has been a problem for years, and DCCC in some sense, is the cookie-cutter approach. It's the cookie-cutter approach to how you run campaigns, you know, everywhere in the United States. I say this in Minnesota all the time. Minnesota is a pretty good microcosm of national politics, and I always used to say that the Democratic Party in Minnesota has an absolutely brilliant strategy for how to win re-election in Minneapolis and St. Paul. And I say that because those are liberal enclaves. And then we need a strategy that gets you beyond those liberal enclaves.
Okay, so wipe that smirk off your face, Ron Abramson. Is it that the DNC is failing, or is that they just don't even know what their job is? They still haven't figured out what the task at hand is. You know, I know that Obama wanted his guy. He got Perez. What did Perez mean? Was that to basically maintain the Obama legacy, or is that to actually move the country forward?
So let's bookend the discussion. Maybe it just all comes back to money and who's funding the party and who's funding everything. And that those are the interests we continue to exalt without paying closer attention to the grassroots.
Wow.
And who is he running against? He was running against Pete Buttigieg.
And on that note, everyone, thank you so much for our Rethink the Week. I really appreciate it. Dean Spiliotta, Southern New Hampshire University, Dave Schultz, Hamline University, and Ron Abramson, immigration lawyer. This is Rethink the Week. You went to university, too, of course. We're going to end with, monsieur?
Going to end with this little light of mine, which is Civil Rights Anthem, Fannie Lou Hamer et al.
This little light of mine.